Traditional journalism is in trouble. Even the hallowed New York Times had its back to the wall and has announced it will begin charging for its online content in less than a year. But the flip side of the coin is the flourishing personal and impassioned news stories from blogs and social media. But how does their agenda compare to traditional news sources, and what can traditional news learn from them? Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn. This hour, we're joined by Mark Jerkowitz, Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, talking about a new study called New Media, Old Media, examining the content of traditional media as compared with blogs and social media. And I hope you'll be joining us this hour. Have you ditched your newspaper subscription for a sampling of news blogs, YouTube videos, and Twitter headlines? Would you pay for content from The Times, CNN, and The Washington Post? Or do you like your news more personal and sometimes irreverent? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Mark Jerkowitz, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be there.
Could you tell us a little bit about this latest study on new media, old media? What were you looking for?
Well, yeah, let me backtrack just a tad. In 2007, we at the Pew Research Center started something called the News Coverage Index, which was literally a way of measuring the output of the mainstream media through five different sectors: newspapers, some online news sites, cable news, some radio news, a sampling of radio news, and network television news, and about 50 different outlets. And every week we would produce a report sort of showing what stories were being picked up and the trajectory of those stories. And about a year ago, given where the media universe is going, we started a companion weekly report called the New Media Index. And what it did was track three things. Number one, the stories most linked to on blogs; two, the subjects most linked to on Twitter; and three, the most viewed news in the category of news videos on YouTube. So we would get a sense fundamentally of what the new social media were pursuing on a regular basis. And the idea for this survey was to actually take a look after getting 1 year of this new media data and looking at, A, how does the new media agenda differ from the traditional media agenda, and two, what differences are there, and there are substantial ones, between, for example, Twitter and blogs and YouTube, which is kind of an animal unto itself, because people tend to sort of, you know, in their own minds think, oh, that's all social media, that's all new media, but they're very different animals. So that was the idea of this survey. We had enough sort of, you know, longitudinal data to say, let's take a snapshot here and make some comparisons.
Well, let's take a moment to frame what we're talking about here. What is at stake? Why look at this now?
Well, the reason to look at it now is a number of things. But obviously, in your setup, you sort of suggested it. We are in an era of, if not unprecedented, media transformation, certainly one of very dramatic media transformation. Everybody who pays attention to the industry knows what's been happening. We've essentially had a dramatic fragmentation of the news media. And the mainstream media, the old mainstream media that used to fundamentally be the mass medium in the media in this country, basically daily newspapers and network TV news, have been losing readers and audience for a long time. We have this entire sort of digital information revolution. People are getting their news in many, many different ways. One of the things we found, you know, at the top of this survey was that 44% of online news users get their news a few times a week through, you know, other people, email, social networking sites. So we really wanted to take a look at, as this media universe evolves, as the former big newsrooms break down into small newsrooms, as citizens start to take over some of the jobs that paid, trained journalists did, you know, what are we getting in this new media universe that we don't get in the old media universe, and vice versa? Because obviously, for those who are paying attention, there's going to have to be, and we know that there's this tremendous economic crisis in journalism today. What's fundamentally happened is a huge loss of revenue and audience for a number of old media structures. We expected that. Everybody expected that. But the corollary was that at some point, with all these eyeballs going online, that we would sort of have a baton pass here in a relay race, that fundamentally, you know, there'd be some kind of revenue model that would work for all these eyeballs in new media that would allow and sustain the preservation of newsrooms. And by that all I mean is news gathering, that we have enough subsidy to pay for the kind of news gathering that we think we want in this country, that's sophisticated, that's good, hard reporting that often costs money. The fly in the ointment has been, A, aside from a dramatic economic recession, which has certainly hurt the media across the board, that there has yet to be, as everyone's painfully aware, any real functioning, replicatable business model for all this online traffic.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't paying for news. Advertisers have been slow to migrate. The kind of display advertising that drove the old media culture isn't working as effectively online. And so suddenly, there's nobody there to take that baton handoff. And the real question that obviously people care about the journalism industry are asking is, we don't know how long this period is going to last. We don't know what models are going to evolve. But in the interim, who and what is going to pay for quality journalism, investigative reporting, beat reporting, original reporting? And that's sort of the quandary we're at right now.
Well, getting into your study then a little bit, you looked at how often the headlines in traditional media, like your newspapers, diverged or came together along with the top headlines from news blogs, YouTube videos, and Twitter. And tell us a little bit about what you found there.
Well, we find that the you know, traditional media and the new media are very different when it comes to sort of the subjects that most interest them. Just to give you some of the basic data, the blogs shared the same lead story in the 49 weeks that we really looked at, so it was a little under a year, share the same lead story with the traditional media in just 13 out of the 49 weeks we looked at. Twitter was even less likely to share. We looked at 29 weeks of Twitter. In only 4 weeks was their top story the same as that in the mainstream media. On YouTube, again, which is kind of a different animal, 8 out of 49 weeks. Now, it's worth noting, so the first thing we notice is obviously we don't have the same level of interest in the same kinds of stories in the new media and old media. And it's important to know that what we're talking about here with blogs and Twitter are the stories that are being linked to. So in the case of our blog universe, we find that the bloggers are obviously linking to many stories that come out of the legacy media, but they don't tend to be the same kinds of stories that the legacy media are producing on a week-to-week basis that generate the most interest, not always, but in the online community. And that's, you know, the key finding here. One of the things I think that's obvious when you think about it is that much of the mainstream media still functions as kind of a headline service. It's okay, this is an important event, people need to know about this, so we're going to report about it. Particularly in the blogs, what we find is it's almost like activating a keyboard. There are communities out there. There are communities that grow around same interests and subjects and issues that unite people who don't know each other, but are all over the world. And what we tend to find there is specific issues that don't necessarily have to be the quote-unquote most important issues from the prism of the traditional media may activate a few of those keys and may set off the individual communities that then dominate the blogosphere for a week. We've seen two issues like that. One is that have substantially gotten more coverage in the blogosphere than in the mainstream media. One is the issue of gay marriage. Now, you know, it certainly gets covered in the mainstream media to a certain extent, and when we have issues like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, other elements of gay rights get covered. But in the blogosphere, the communities that care about that issue are following it much more closely. So if there's an action by the Maine legislature or, you know, the Ohio legislature or there's some referendum in some state, that is likely to generate a much more robust conversation in the blogosphere than it will in the mainstream media. The same thing, interestingly enough, for the issue of global warming. You can argue, obviously, or it seems like there's a lot of that coverage in the mainstream press. There's some. But actually, for example, the quote-unquote ClimateGate scandal, which happened earlier this year, was much more of a subject of continuing interest for bloggers than it was for the mainstream media. So what you end up seeing are kind of these very specific issues that seem to touch, you know, these online communities wherever they exist, and like-minded people, or sometimes opposite-minded people, generate a discussion that kind of dominates the blogs, at least in our sample, in a given week.
Well, it seems interesting given the, for example, the ClimateGate example that you just gave, mm-hmm. that with the blogosphere in general, it seems to operate with just a whiff of conspiracy theory, the sense of being still a little bit underground, I think.
Well, there's certainly, put it this way, there's a couple of things that are interesting in the blogs in terms of the quality of the conversation. One is it's obviously, and this makes sense, it's obviously personalized a lot more than in the mainstream media. You know, you don't, that's a set of sort of journalistic values. You don't, I mean, in the cable universe, every sentence begins with a personal pronoun. But, you know, generally, reporters are certainly more likely to just give a straight news report than say, I felt this or that or whatever the case might be. Obviously, in the blogosphere, you're looking at people who can say, this happened to me. For, you know, a classic example of this kind of conversation was when we had the Icelandic volcano. And, you know, what you got in the blogosphere was a conversation about it, but it was mostly first-hand accounts, or to a large degree, first-hand accounts of people who couldn't get their flights, who got stuck in other countries for a week on edge. So, you get a kind of a personalized conversation. Two, a lot of it is ideological, and it's argumentative, and in some respects, it does kind of remind you, in written form, of the kind of things you get on the cable talk shows at night, you know. What the difference may be that in the blogosphere you're going to get a wide variety of voices, but a lot of it is argumentative and commentary. And the third piece of I would sort of agree. I think there's a little more sense of, hey, we don't, you know, a conspiracy tinge to a lot of the conversation, a sense that we're not being told the whole story. The other thing that's kind of interesting is there are just sort of quirky things that show up in the blogosphere on a regular basis. One of the things we notice, it's not really funny, I don't know why I'm laughing, but there seems to be this kind of interest in the passing of what I would call B-list celebrities. And this almost resembles kind of, you know, what an audience might think of if they're sitting in a bar one night, you know, having a few drinks, and somebody says, hey, how many movies did so-and-so make? Or, you know, what was the best movie that Burt Reynolds ever made? Not that a lot of people have those conversations, but... And so, for example, when Dom DeLuise passed away. Now, Dom was a good comedian, and he made movies, but, you know, he wasn't somebody that was lionized in the mainstream press, wasn't a series of page one appreciations. There were a lot of people in the blogosphere who wanted to talk about what they thought of him, what they liked, what is their favorite work. The same thing, ironically, for the TV pitchman Billy Mays, okay, who everybody who's ever seen a product hawked on television recognizes. And there's this kind of a sense, it's almost a sort of a combination of trivia and sort of cultural something, and people end up talking about these people at some great length. The other thing that's kind of interesting that shows up much more in the blogosphere than in the mainstream media is interest in science. And a lot of it is, you know, a little bit offbeat science. The discovery of a new species of rat. The discovery that cats may manipulate their owners' emotions with certain purrs, okay? And cat owners can speak to that, not me, but sounds like it's probably true since they're smarter than us. 2 weeks ago, there was a huge conversation in the blogosphere about this sort of artificial DNA development. So we do see a lot of interest, and again, this sort of reminds me of these communities of interest, of these often somewhat offbeat, sometimes more mainstream scientific issues that get far more scant coverage in the mainstream press.
Well, and speaking of common ground, though, for a moment, between traditional and new media, a few areas of common ground, common headlines, were the Iran post-election protests, the earthquake in Haiti, and Michael Jackson.
Yeah, Michael Jackson, I think Michael Jackson, you know, sort of supersedes any artificial or otherwise barriers between media. There was an incredible fascination with him across the board. So there's no doubt about that. Iran is a very interesting one. We haven't talked much about Twitter, but the Twitter conversation, and it's obviously a briefer one since, you know, we're talking about 140 characters, or, you know, is different than the blogosphere conversation. It's a lot less oriented on politics. It's also a lot less tied to original stories produced by the legacy media. Here you're much more likely to see stories or items produced by the online-only media. And it's very technology-oriented. Twitterers love to talk about the latest whatever is facing Apple. There's a lot of Twitter items themselves, but we have, and so it's a now, in many ways, it's a narrower agenda, and you could sort of understand that. But we found twice in our range of coverage where Twitter really did play a sort of dramatic role in sort of organizing these communities that we talk about online. And the biggest one was during the Iran protests. Now, a lot of people, obviously, if you remember, following the June 12th elections, obviously there were protests, violent protests in the streets of Iran. Some people called it the Twitter revolution. Now, we should point out that a lot of that came from people who were tweeting from inside Iran, you know, and producing some of the only live, you know, eyewitness accounts of what was happening in Iran, with much of the outside media being shut down. But even for those who weren't in country, there was this tremendous, in the Twitter community, sense of, here's where to go to support the protesters. Here's where to go to find out the latest that's happening inside the country. For 7 weeks in a row, I believe, Iran was the top topic on Twitter, and it really became kind of a bulletin board for people who cared about the issue. Here's where you want to go. Here's where you want to voice your support for the protesters. Turn your avatar to green in sympathy with the protesters. We also saw that to a somewhat lesser extent, but we saw the same function happen after the Haiti earthquake, where people very much used it as an organizing tool to get money, support to the people in Haiti. So in that way, we see the emergence of Twitter as, you know, really as sort of communal activism in the online community. It doesn't happen often. Its news agenda, you know, is fundamentally different from both the blogs and the mainstream press. But in those kinds of cases, you do see this real social media function of Twitter coming to the fore.
Well, we need to take a quick break right now, and then we'll return and continue our conversation this morning with Mark Dierkowitz, the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, talking about the new study that he was part of called New Media, Old Media, examining the content of traditional media as compared with blogs and other social media. And we'd love to hear your take this morning. Why do you read blogs or Twitter headlines or YouTube videos? Do you like that first person feet on the ground feel about it, or do you go because you think you're hearing news content that you wouldn't hear otherwise in the mainstream press? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, back with you this Memorial Day. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, as we're talking about a study called New Media, Old Media, examining what the differences are and the common ground between blogs, Twitter, and YouTube, and traditional media like the New York Times, the Washington Post. We're talking this hour with Mark Dierkowitz, Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. And I wonder, Mark Dierkowitz, is it possible to extrapolate here on the reason that people go to these new media is because you get so much more of a sense of this first-person narrative. In terms of the old legacy media you were discussing, you always hear the adage, make it local, or all news is local. Well, you take that to the ultimate extreme when you go to these new media, don't you?
Well, there, you know, on some level in the new media universe, certainly all media are personal. There's no doubt about it. But you know, look, we're in a completely different media environment. I first of all, yes, there is this idea of obviously a kind of sharing of information at the grassroots level, and obviously an accessibility that you don't have from the mainstream media. Now, you know, in recent years, the mainstream media has gotten a lot more accessible to the broader world and the news consumer than it used to be, frankly. You know, I worked at the Boston Globe for 10 years, and I was the ombudsman at that newspaper. And I can tell you that, you know, when I first got there, people who wanted to communicate with anybody at that newspaper, you know, might as well have been looking for a needle in a haystack in many respects. Journalists didn't have email addresses published. They didn't have phone numbers published. You know, there was this real sort of, in many respects, there felt like there was this moat around the big media institution, and it was very hard for the news consumer to sort of, you know, cross that moat and find out what was going on. That's changed in recent years, and you know, it may not have changed, you know, the goodness of anyone's hearts, but obviously as the traditional media has scraped harder and harder for a vanishing dollar, they've understood that one of the things you need to do is get closer to your public. So now, you know, even at the big newspapers all over the country, everybody publishes their email address, everybody's phone number is published, many of the top journalists at these organizations go online and do online chats. So there's been a closing of this sort of paternalistic gap in recent years. But it still doesn't come close to approximating, you know, the level of intimacy you can get with, you know, by following a particular blog or by following somebody on Twitter. And you're also making, you know, judgments, and this is a big fact in the new, you know, in the today's media universe. You know, you're creating your own niche news service in many ways. That's, you know, we know that obviously, you know, the way people use the online world these days is mostly search. You know, people, you know, who land at news websites don't usually, that aren't necessarily going there because they want to see what CNN.com has to say or whatever. They're often going there through search. So they're already narrowing what they're looking for. And, you know, but we've said it for a long time, and it's certainly, you know, proving to be true. The news consumer, the average news consumer, first of all, can become a participant now in a way that he or she never could have before. And second, they can choose their own news agendas. They can pick and choose, you know, who they want to follow, what they want to follow, what they want to pay attention to, as opposed to the old days when you turned on Walter Cronkite for 22 minutes and he gave you, you could turn him off after the top story if you wanted to, but, you know, he basically gave you a wide wrap-up of the day's news, and then you thumbed through the daily newspaper. Now, you might like the sports section better than, and you might go there first in the front section, but odds are you'd thumb through the newspaper and see what we used to call serendipity. You know, some story that you hadn't planned on reading that you just caught your attention. There's a lot. In some ways, there's considerably less of that now as people are making more assertive choices about what kind of news and information they want. And one of the, you know, to go on a bit of a tangent, one of the byproducts of that in this day and age is with so much ideological media now available to people, both in cable and in the online world, you can literally choose to subject yourself or to expose yourself to a particular worldview of the news day in and day out that is never impinged upon by an opposing worldview. So, you know, the interest in those kinds of things, I think, is just accelerated in this media world. And again, we should point out that for the purposes of our study, you know, we are looking at sort of bloggers that are paying attention to news. There's a whole, obviously, you know, there's a whole blogger universe of people that blog about very personal things, that blog about nothing but pop culture. So even the differences that we see showing up in this particular study are somewhat magnified by our sample and our universe. If you really went to the broader universe of blogs, you'd find an even much more diverse kind of, you know, news universe than we're talking about here.
Well, let's take a call now. We have Jean joining us from Minneapolis. Hey, Jean.
Hi. I watch both traditional media and read traditional media, but I also rely heavily on new media because I find old media to be wide and shallow. I often have a lot of questions when I read something. I said, well, what about this and what about this and why didn't they ask this and why didn't they talk about that? And so I often turn to new media to get my questions answered. I don't find... And I often find a deeper conversation there than I can ever get with traditional media, either broadcast media or on newspapers, although there are some newspapers that do a very good job at going deep, like the New York Times and the Christian Science Monitor, for instance.
Yeah, you're sort of making the critique of it's a mile wide and an inch deep. And, you know, for much of the mainstream news media, you know, that's a significant issue. Obviously, there is some of the greatest journalism in this country has been produced by newspapers over the years. They still, to this day, remain the place where you are more likely to see a major investigative piece. But part of that mission and goal, frankly, you know, there have been so many cuts in so many newsrooms in recent years for economic reasons that it's even sort of narrowed the range of what the mainstream media can do. But I guess my question to your caller would be, after you've sort of looked at the daily paper or looked at a local newscast, what kind of sites do you go to for a sort of a deeper reportorial sense of the news? Where are you going for those kind of things?
Well, I sometimes do a Google search, but sometimes I also go to my friends on Facebook.
Yep.
They often have links to things that I'm interested in, and then when I go there, those places lead me to other places.
Right.
And links to other things that have deeper conversations.
That's one of the phenomena that we found in this study. Almost half the people, essentially, who are online users are getting news and from, you know, frankly, from friends via emails or exactly what you said, Facebook. And let's face it, let's think about that transaction for a second. You know, people often ask questions like, who's your most trusted journalist or whatever the case might be. Well, no journalist, and frankly, obviously, the public has a lot of antipathy toward a lot of journalism and journalists these days, but you're not going to trust any journalist as much as you're going to trust a lifelong friend or somebody you know well whose judgment you've been exposed to. So this is a way, in many respects, of people choosing news from the people they most trust. And certainly, there's no doubt about it. You can go... You know, I mean, one of the original thoughts of online journalism was going to be, hey, you know, we're going to go so many layers deep. We have this infinite news hole. And, yeah, you can read a good story in the newspaper. You can watch one on the TV news. But then you can go to our site and you can link. And, if it's the State of the Union, we'll give you the text of every State of the Union, you know, that's ever been recorded. Now, you know, truth be told, most people aren't going that deep. But certainly... If you have the time and the inclination and, frankly, the ability to sort out fact from fiction, which is a more difficult issue for people in this new media universe, then obviously you're going to have more choices than ever. And it's much more up to you. You no longer are, you know, subject to how much they want to tell you in 2.5 minutes on the NBC Nightly News. If you have the inclination, you can go much deeper. And many people are taking advantage of this. Many people aren't.
Does that mean people don't care as much about the voice of authority, Walter Cronkite style, where you really hear from someone that you should respect and is up a little bit on a platform?
I don't think anybody would ever fill that niche again. You know, I think back to, you know, the most famous Cronkite story, which, of course, was, and obviously I'm dating myself and anybody else who remembers Walter Cronkite, but, you know, the famous story about him going to Vietnam after the Tet Offensive. And coming back, and in a very rare bit of quasi-editorializing, you know, announcing that from his observations, this war had to be negotiated because the United States couldn't win. To this day, the Pentagon is convinced that Walter Cronkite was instrumental in helping to move mass public opinion against the war. Whether that's true or not, I can't say. But, you know, there's enough of a perception out there that it probably resonates to some degree. In this day and age, you cannot imagine any single individual in the news universe having that kind of widespread authority and credibility. In point of fact, you know, if somebody said that today, somebody at a rival network, you know, in many respects, would probably come on the air the next day and denounce them. You know, and say they were wrong-headed. And frankly, to some degree, this is very much a function of what the cable news universe has turned out to be where we are right now. You know, you've got CNN, which is ostensibly in the middle, not as ideological, certainly in prime time, which is having, you know, huge rating problems. So on the right, you've got Fox with a primetime lineup of conservative hosts. On the left, you've got MSNBC with a primetime lineup of liberal hosts. Not only are they giving you different views of the world, not only are they giving you different opinions about things they might even agree on, but frankly, part of the editorial content of those kind of cable networks is to tell you that the other guy is doing bad journalism. You know, there's this sort of, you know, intramural attack culture within the opinionated journalism world today that says half of the journalists out there are telling you the wrong thing. So there's no chance that anyone would, you know, be able to command anywhere near the authority of a Walter Cronkite in this day and age. Matter of fact, one of our sister projects, the Pew Research Center for the People in the Press, polls people from time to time about sort of who your most trusted or favorite journalist is. Last time they did it in the 80s, it was sort of what you might expect. Actually, Walter Cronkite was retired, but he was still the most trusted journalist at that point. But then it was people like Dan Rather, and, you know, again, you have to remember that in those days, particularly the nightly news audience was bigger than it is now, and they were the real mass media producers. Now, if you look at it, I think the last list that came out nobody got more than like 3 or 4%. People like Bill O'Reilly and John Stewart were atop the list. So not only do we have a structurally fragmenting media universe, but we have, in the sense of credibility, we have a fragmenting media universe as well.
Well, the only person I can think of who would hold that kind of cultural, authority is Oprah. And she's not a journalist. Well, she, I guess, I don't know. I don't know what Oprah is. Does she count as a journalist?
I would call Oprah a media mogul in her own right.
A media
mogul.
But, I mean, that just tells you, because it seems like people would want someone who crosses that line between entertainment and information.
Well, you know, that's a pretty good example. Now, you know, and let's face it, going on Oprah, before a presidential election is now, you know, a kind of, you know, that's one of the things every candidate's got to do. George Bush famously went on that on her show and even bust her on the cheek. And she is a widely respected, I would call her cultural figure more than anything else. But the issue with Oprah is she's not a news reporter. So she's never going to go to Afghanistan and come back and say, you know, I've been there for 3 weeks, and it's my humble opinion that, you know, we won't defeat the Taliban. So, in a way, yes, she's got, you know, widespread credibility when it frankly comes to a book or selling a product or even being someone where you can get a fair shake if you're a politician who wants to go on and, you know, and show a side of you that may not show up in the campaign every day. But she wouldn't be the kind of person who would essentially bring you a news report that would sort of, you know, in any way resemble what Cronkite did on that broadcast.
Well, granted, she would never bring you a report from Afghanistan, but it seems to me that there is an overlap there between the kinds of things that people like to view on the in the blogosphere on these online sources and how they like their news now. It's from this interest in, say, Michael Jackson, alongside maybe a more serious headline. It's a blending of hard news and just entertainment.
Well, there's a blending of hard news and entertainment. There's also a blending of news and opinion in the same story. We're creating in many respects a new category of sort of story, which is kind of a news hybrid. And people, you know, which in the old days, and again, and there's not nostalgia, I'm not sure this was the best way to do it, but, you know, There were real silos for all this stuff. You know, the rest of the paper was devoted to hard news. You wrote your opinions on the editorial page or in the columns. Once in a while, if you basically had something to say or a point of view based on a lot of hard reporting, you might end up with a page one news analysis. But now, you know, we find, you know, in the same story, a liberal mix of some reporting and lots of opinion. And frankly, we're finding that to a great degree on sort of these newer online sites. And there is some evidence in polling that people are becoming, particularly young people, are becoming more and more used to that. They think that's kind of, the way journalism ought to be. They would get a robust argument, obviously, from people who've been in the industry for a number of years. But that's certainly what's happening.
We have another phone call here. This is Dave with us from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. I'm a news junkie, and I watch and listen and read mostly all day. And the comparison that I wanted to bring up with, say, Fox on the Fox on the right and MSNBC on the left, Fox is on the right, and I think there's only 4 hours that they claim is news, the rest is opinion, but even where they say that, you know, they're reporting news is just full of opinion. And their reporting is things like they push things like death panels, government takeover, and things that are just not true. And I don't, you know, to say on these other guys on the left as if they are equal to what is going on the right, and that's just not true. The people on the left are not misleading me. They are choosing what subjects to cover, but they're not lying to me about what is going on. So to say, you know, MSNBC is on the left and Fox is on the right, that's fine. But, I mean, Chris Matthews is not going to be on there lying about, you know, things that George Bush didn't do to try to make me think he's doing something he's not doing at the time. That just doesn't happen. But that happens all the time on the right.
Do you watch Fox News?
I I do grab a beer and go for some entertainment. You know, I do watch Bill O'Reilly and just get a kick out of, you know, first you have to learn the facts first through the day, and then you turn on the television to find out these guys are just, you know, I mean, they're just absolutely not telling the truth. I don't see that on the left. They will cover a certain part, but they're not going to tell me half-truths.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Dave. And it's interesting that Dave still watches both the MSNBC and Fox. And do people like that kind of opinion or point of view? Opinion is not the right word, but do they like strong points of view in their journalism?
Well, cable viewers do. And we should talk about the cable news universe for a second. You know, these days everybody's talking about, you know, Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, or Maddow and Olbermann as, you know, as sort of the big television guys that everybody thinks about. And you know, the network newscasts are fossils. They're Tyrannosaurus Rex waiting for the comet, the asteroid to hit them. You know, they have been losing mass audience. But we should say one thing first. The top, you know, cable news shows in prime time, you know, get a couple of million viewers. Even as bad as it is with the network nightly broadcast, they're going to get 6, 7, 8 million viewers apiece a night. So the first thing we have to recognize is that more people are not watching cable news than are watching Katie Couric and Brian Williams and Diane Sawyer. First and foremost, no matter how much buzz these people generate. The second thing is that, you know, there is no doubt that if you're watching primetime cable news on a regular basis now, you're pretty much kind of a political or a news junkie. I mean, all three of the cable news networks had big, big years in 2008. Totally understandable. This was an unprecedented election. There was tremendous level of interest. You know, some of that interest obviously dropped off in 2009. Now, Fox News is doing well in the ratings, and frankly is doing well in the ratings, by in many respects, certainly in prime time, setting itself up as the opposition to President Obama. But what you're getting now, the people who are tuning into cable every night might tend to be ideological. They're certainly very interested in the news. They're a small, you know, frankly, segment of the prime time audience. And the prevailing theory is now, as CNN continues to sink, I mean, at one point, you know, MSNBC was a distant third in that rating battle. And then they made a very strategic decision to go liberal in primetime programming. On comes Keith Olbermann. On comes Rachel Maddow. On comes Ed Schultz. And they sort of set themselves up as the anti-Fox. Well, guess what? To some degree, that's been a successful strategy. And Fox is obviously, O'Reilly is the top-rated primetime host. They do the best of all. So now there's a theory circulating out there in the world that the reason that CNN is doing more poorly is nobody who tunes in cable news at night wants to see anything but, you know, hardcore politics and ideological politics. I'm not sure how many viewers there are, like your last caller, who get both sides, which is probably a fairly healthy thing. But O'Reilly gets some crossover viewers. There's no doubt about that. But basically, you know, the conventional wisdom about CNN's problem is, hey, they don't, you know, because they've chosen not to basically get an ideological food fight every night between 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock, they're losing viewers. There's no market left anymore for non-ideological cable talk. Now, frankly, you could also argue that maybe there's something, you know, that there'd be plenty of room for good news-reported stuff on one cable network at night, and CNN may not be doing a good enough job of it, frankly. But that's what people in the industry think now, that if you're going to be a success on cable prime time, you better be argumentative, you better have a point of view, and you better, in some ways, be very polarizing.
Well, we need to take our second break right now. We are talking this morning with Mark Jerkowitz, Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, talking about the new study called New Media, Old Media, examining the content of traditional media as compared with blogs, Twitter, and YouTube. And we'd love to know what you think this morning. Have you ditched maybe your newspaper subscription for a sampling of news blogs, YouTube videos, and Twitter headlines? Do you prefer one over the other? Do you like to sample from traditional sources and from new media? Would you pay for your content from the New York Times? You can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can shoot us an email if you'd rather at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert in this morning for Kathleen Dunn. And coming up at 11 o'clock, Jim Packard is in for Larry Mueller as a holiday tradition continues with a program on birdwatching. Jim Packard's guests are Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and DNR wildlife educator Bill Volkert. So birdwatching coming up after 11. Talking this morning and this hour with Mark Jerkowitz, Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, talking about the study New Media, Old Media, looking at legacy journalism like the New York Times and the Washington Post as compared with Twitter and YouTube, also the proliferation of news blogs out there right now. And Mark Jerkowitz, we alluded to this a little bit earlier on about how citizens really want to be involved and pick exactly what they're reading, going a little bit deeper, and being a more personal one-on-one relationship with the news. What does this say about the direction that someone like the New York Times might take? Will there be more collaboration between citizens and news reporting organizations?
That's certainly one of the things that looks like it's sort of inevitable. And now we get to the issue of sort of what kind of new, you know, media universe are we going to build here? Out of necessity, frankly, to continue to support, you know, quality journalism and information. You know, the New York Times obviously is, as I think you alluded to at the beginning of the show, is now talking about some kind of paywall, and that's been a big debate, you know, in the media universe, whether or not these legacy media outlets will, you know, start to charge more aggressively for content. I can tell you we did a survey recently of a number of newsroom executives, and while, you know, paywalls are an option, they are not the thing that most media organizations are counting the most heavily on. So in terms of the kind of newsroom of the future we're going to get, there is absolutely no doubt we're going to get increasing collaboration between all sorts of partners. You're going to get citizens blogging in legacy media. In the town of Boston where I lived for many years, we now have college students in investigative journalism programs writing investigative pieces for the newspaper. There is going to be a redefinition of the newsroom to some extent. And, you know, one of the terms that people use is there's going to be a pro-am, you know, kind of collaboration, meaning that there are, you know, that you're going to have professional journalists sort of teamed up with amateur journalists on some level. Now, the New York Times is probably not the best example to talk about that from because it still remains an incredibly powerful and potent legacy outlet with a real distinguishable brand. But for a lot of other organizations that are fighting hard, looking for content, trying to stay around, there's no doubt about it that we're going to get, you know, more collaboration. The real question becomes, how do we meld the standards? Or do we meld the standards? You know, are citizen journalists, you know, going to be held anywhere near the same standards as traditional journalists? Should they be? One of the things that we've obviously seen in this country is a very robust citizen journalist movement. And what we mean there are, in a lot of local communities where reporting has been cut back, you're getting these sort of homegrown operations run by local citizens. You know, it's not exactly investigative reporting every day. It can be a combination of blogs, observational stuff, some reporting, some coverage of meetings. This has been a very big issue. A couple of years ago, the J Lab, which looks at this kind of stuff, identified about 600, 700, or 800 of these citizen journalism organizations, these local citizen sites, you know, throughout the country. Many, there were different business models, varying degrees of professionalism. But one of the things that was also clear about them, frankly, is they are very much labors of love and passion. And, you know, a bunch of people who were involved in these sites were surveyed, and somewhere in the neighborhood of about 50% said, we don't make money, we don't even really care about making money. So the truth is what you've got are really impassioned citizens who are doing this, you know, out of concern for their community or specific issues. But what that inevitably also means is, forgetting about the standards of those places, some of which may be good, is you're going to get tremendous churn. People are going to burn out. You're not going to get a lot of people who are going to work for free at those kinds of places. So for a while, people toyed with the idea of this sort of citizen journalism, this homegrown amateur journalism, coming in to really play a major, major supplemental role and in some degrees replacing the traditional or legacy media. That's not likely to happen, but we are certainly going to get sort of broader combinations of people getting together. For example, one thing I read about last week is there's a paper in Marin County in California. I think it's called the Point Reyes Light. It's had a long and distinguished career, and actually won a Pulitzer at one point. And its owner was having a very tough time making a go of it, and it recently got sold to a conglomerate of basically some journalists, some community leaders, some citizens, some teachers, and it's going to be run as a non-profit operation or low-profit operation. And we're going to see, you know, people say, always ask, well, how, you know, what's going to be the model for journalism? Anybody who tells you they got the answer isn't telling you the truth. You know, the hackneyed cliche at this point is that there's no silver bullet, but unfortunately cliches are used because they're often right. We're going to see all sorts of creative measures and creative combinations of both revenue-raising, fundraising, and reportorial resource itself if we're going to see journalism emerge healthier from this period of turmoil. And there's a considerable debate about that as well.
Let's take another phone call now. We have Jim joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I don't know if I'm an aberration, but I don't agree with the idea that the industry idea that people nowadays they only want to hear news that's in line with their own political point of view. I tend to be liberal in my politics, but I'm not so keen on listening to Keith Olbermann or A.B. Goodman or Tom Hartman. Frankly, I wish there were more programs like the Lehrer Report, because I think that is good, solid news. It covers the subjects well, and is reasonably unbiased. And as far as newsprint, I don't really know of any American newspaper that I even bother with anymore. I prefer to go to the European newspapers like The Guardian.
Hmm. What did you used to read an American newspaper?
Yeah, the one right, a local one right here, which
the Journal
I
Sentinel?
Find is, I don't have much. I don't care for it very much anymore.
I understand. Well, your first point about, you know, people, don't misread me. I don't, you know, the majority of people will still say, and I believe them, that they want unbiased news, that they want straightforward news, and they want news they can trust. No doubt about it. The PBS NewsHour is a pretty damn good example of that. And a successful programming. What I am saying is that for those who don't necessarily feel that way, there are certainly more opportunities than there ever were before to indulge in that kind of what we would call the journalism of validation, which is, yep, I like this show because I agree with everything they say. Fortunately, that's not a majority of people in the country. As a matter of fact, as I pointed out, the cable news audiences in primetime are still relatively small. But the option certainly exists, and I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, if we look at our increasingly polarized political debate and civic dialogue, while there are many, many reasons for it, and not being a political scientist, I could probably only scratch the surface, to some extent, and maybe it's a minor one, you'd have to think that the shouting heads on cable television and elsewhere are certainly not, you know, are on some level a contributor to that kind of trend.
Well, thank you much for the call, Jim. And another from Jerry in Waterford. Hey, Jerry.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I just want to point out that the online community does do some investigative research, as pointed out, or an example, which is the document that they found to be forgery by Dan Rather, who he said was from an unimpeachable source. The online community quickly caught that it was, in fact, a forgery. And,
That's correct. There have been a number of things like that in the online community. It was the online community, I believe, where Trent Trott's remark at Strom Thurmond's birthday party surfaced. Talking Points Memo, which is a liberal blog and site, deserves some degree of credit for piecing together various aspects of the U.S. Justice Department scandal. You're absolutely right. The Rather incident on 60 Minutes 2 was something that was discerned first in the blogosphere. And one of the reasons that it's, and the thing that, and that's The value of that is now. I mean, this is literally the, in theory, every American, you know, can be a journalist these days. So, for example, one, you know, over and over, people are often asked, I've seen surveys on this, you know, if you know something intimately about a particular story, the more you know intimately about a particular event or story, the less likely you're going to think that the news account in your newspaper or on television got it right, and you're probably going to be right to some extent. Well, in the old days, if you watched, you know, 60 Minutes or any other TV program, a local newscast, and you saw them reporting on a story that you knew intimately about, and you saw that they were wrong, or they had gotten some fact fundamentally wrong, your response is going to be to turn to your wife or husband and say, I can't believe these guys. They're totally missed that story. Now, you can go to your computer and you can prove it, and you can be picked up instantly.
Right.
And that's what's changed dramatically. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, you've got a ton of blogs that are out there with reporting teams on the ground, but it does mean that those kinds of people that have special information to bear can do so and disseminate that information much more quickly than simply, you know, venting their frustration to their loved ones.
And we have to wrap it up now, but thank you, Mark Jerkowitz, so much. It's been great talking with you. Interesting
stuff. My pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Jerkowitz, the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for answering your phone calls. And I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen will return. She'll be with you tomorrow.